Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to Simon Jenkins, the distinguished former editor of the Evening Standard and the Times, and he's written a terrific new book, A Short History of America from Tea Party to Trump, and it's very beautifully planned because we're about to celebrate the 250th anniversary of American independence from Britain, and a state visit is planned by the King and Queen to America, which you wrote in The Guardian, Simon, you said should go ahead.
Yes. When I wrote it, I was more convinced than I am now. Like, that's 3 days ago.
Yeah.
I feel very strongly that state visits are not about government policies. And they're not about actually heads of government. The trouble in America is that the head of government is also the president. And just at the moment, the president of the United States is somewhat controversial. And it looks as if our head of state is in some sense or another honoring their head of state by visiting him. And I am beginning to think it really ought to be postponed as long as that war is going on.
Oh, yes.
But that's the limit of it. The most important thing is state visits are visits by one people to another people, not a government to a government.
And your book goes right back to the prehistoric origins of America, but a good part of it is about 1776 and independence and the Constitution, which is a remarkable document, and you think it can survive Trump's attempts to ride roughshod over it.
Well, I've always been told never predict, but we have been here before. There've been one or two presidents who've been equally out of sorts. And there's no suggestion that the most basic of the constitutional tenets against autocracy, which is the term limit, which we don't have in Britain, the term limit, will apply. And he's not pretending it won't apply. He sort of says things. But this man can't be trusted saying anything. So I'm sure he'll be gone in 3 years, and we'll then have to see what mess we've got to clear up. But the Constitution, you're right, the Constitution is critical. I mean, the whole of American history is built around the Constitution. And the genius, really, of the early founding fathers in putting together a set of tenets to bond 13 tiny colonies left over from Restoration Britain, and in 250 years create one of the world's, or the world's greatest state. And that I regard as a work of genius. It's very interesting to me, and this is in my book the key, that they still are states. They're called states, and the Union is not the United State. It's the United States, plural. And those states' rights are jealously guarded, and they are the key to the continued Union in America. In South America, they tried the same and failed completely, so it's fragmented. America is still a union of states, plural.
And as you say in your book, it is remarkable, rebellions and revolutions in South America never worked. Here was a revolution that worked perfectly and is still, notwithstanding Trump, working today.
Well, I love the way that Americans use the word revolution. I regard it as a war of independence, and it was pretty unrevolutionary. I mean, the Declaration of Independence was full of hypocrisy, particularly about slavery. The treatment of the native people was outrageous. All sorts of things in American history are reputable and disreputable. We can't dodge these things. The most extraordinary thing to me is that it survived, and I think it will survive, yes.
And it's also remarkable that the cause, supposedly, of the War of Independence, tax, essentially, you say, actually was lower in America than here in Britain. Is that right?
Oh, they were hardly taxed. There are many interpretations of the War of Independence. It was pretty self-interested on the part of some big landowners. There's no doubt at all they wanted to be allowed to expand westwards through the Allegheny Mountains, and the British government had expressly said over and over again, you cannot expand America into the continent. They accepted that the rest of the continent was Spanish and French. That's what it was at the time. But the individual states at the time were desperate to expand. They were very expansionist. They were very hardworking. They could handle land. They were brilliant at it, in fact. But the other thing was that the southern states, in fact all the states at the time, but the southern states in particular, had slaves. And they were genuinely afraid that if they went independent, the northern states would tell them that slavery is at an end. And that's one of the fears they had. And they thought that Britain, believe it or not, would defend them in their slavery. That was in the 18th century. And that was another reason for in the case of the South, not going for full independence, and certainly not going for revolution.
And you can see the seeds of the Civil War, can't you, for that reason, in independence, because the open sore of slavery is unsolved.
There's no doubt that was the cause of the Civil War. I mean, it was by then, and we're now in the 1850s and 60s, when slavery really has been ended. I mean, slave trade ended in the 1830s, but slavery was completely unacceptable. Britons who went to America and visited the South were totally appalled. Charles Wesley's famous visit was a bit earlier, but Charles Wesley's famous visit, he simply was shattered by what he saw. It was the way they treated the slaves in the presence of visitors. So America had a terrible time over this, and one early president after another, in the first place, the first six, I think, apart from one, all had slaves. They were all from Virginia.
Yeah.
They were ashamed of it. They expressed the view that this can't go on forever, but they thought it wouldn't be them that bore the price of stopping it. And even when, and this is another controversy which I try and deal with in my book, even when the Civil War was fought and then won by the North, there are plenty of people who felt that the North didn't really win it. The various regulations, laws introduced covering voting and everything in the South effectively stopped slaves being free. A slave had to pay to get out of his employment. He was treated as an indentured servant. It wasn't that different. It really wasn't after then. It really took right into the 20th century for the tradition of the enslavement of black people in the South to end.
And you worked as an intern in the Senate in the early 60s, and even then the racism was remarkable in the South.
It's difficult to say it was racism. It was discrimination. I mean, that's what it was. It was called discrimination. There were cases before the Supreme Court on school segregation and so on, bus segregation. All these things were running issues right into the 20th century.
And can you also see in the founding fathers and the first days in independent America a division that still goes on today? I think you say that in Virginia in the late 18th century they were keen on isolationism. In Massachusetts they were more keen on a missionary approach to the world. And it's funny with Trump, who I think at the time you wrote your book, which was last year, he was relatively isolationist. Well, that's subtly changed over the last couple of weeks, isn't it?
It's fascinating. There's nothing new about presidents who change their mind in office. Woodrow Wilson promised to be an isolationist, ends up founding the League of Nations. Very interesting then. Congress said, no, you can't, and he couldn't join in the end. FDR, in the Second World War, promised the nation in the 45 presidential election, I promise you, I will not send your sons abroad to die. I promise. Extraordinary statement. 2 years later, he did. You had it with Eisenhower, fought in Korea. You had it with Kennedy, fought in Vietnam. You had it with both Bushes, fought overseas, having said they wouldn't. In many ways, Trump is the most isolationist, the most emphatically isolationist. I'm not going to be the police station for the world, all these things. They get there. I suppose they see this vast, powerful Navy, Army and Air Force, by far the biggest in the world. It's just sitting there. It's itching to be used. And an industrial complex, as it's called, behind it, itching to be useful. And they just can't resist. And when you think a good war victory might do me some good, which applied in England too, and Tony Blair certainly thought that. They all wanted a Falklands War, ever since the Falklands War. They simply can't resist the temptation. And they go in, even when, as now, the conditions seem so similar to the last disaster.
Staggering, yeah. You're also very good on the cultural side of America and how much still today America does Ode to Britain. A fascinating thing you say about in the south, towns tended to take royal names, and in the north, they're more likely to name their towns after dissenting towns over here. Why is that the case?
Well, that goes right back to the early days of colonization. The answer is bluntly, in the south, most of the colonists were landed estate owners, many of them evicted during the Civil War in Britain. And they went to America as country gentlemen. And they were royalists in the Civil War. They were fleeing left-wing republicanism or whatever it was going to be in the north. And they called their towns after James and Charles and Charleston, Jamestown, all these, after the royal family.
Virginia after
Elizabeth I. So that was at the very, very beginning. In the north, they tended to be southern Puritan Protestants, and they certainly had no time for monarchs and kings. They were mostly Congregationalists, very devout, but very firmly. If they wanted to recollect anything, it was the decent Cromwellian towns of East Anglia that they went to. Boston was their capital, and almost everywhere in Massachusetts, Connecticut is named after a southern English township, city, or village, almost with nothing to do with the king.
And you also relate America's still very strong Christian religious aspect to the nature of those first Puritan settlers from over here in the 17th century.
I was quite interested that actually Methodism, which took quite a hold in the South, rather than High Church Anglicanism. I really don't know. I can't explain that. I'm sure it's something deep in the ritual of the church. But one of the reasons why Christianity took a hold in the first place, America was founded as a Christian state. I mean, the word God occurs in the various documents they have. It's also, I think, it was one of their defences against new waves of immigrants who they weren't quite sure of. So the church, in a sense, is a very conservative part of American society. Also, and I think this is probably the most important factor, the church was very, very good at welcoming newcomers. So almost everyone in America is not living where they were born. They've moved for some reason. When you move somewhere, it even applies in England, when you move somewhere, you want an institution to attach yourself to meet people through, to make you feel at home. American churches are very, very good at that. And I think that's the reason why they're still very strong, because they're very good at welcoming newcomers.
And you trace a line all the way back from those Puritans. You see a Puritan strain in Reagan's language, that the shining city on a hill goes right back to the 1620s and the Mayflower, doesn't it?
Well, it was the Massachusetts, the right word for it was their mission in life, was deeply biblical. I mean, these were fundamentalist Puritans, and they just felt they were God's people in God's country, and God would see them right, and the rest of the world should watch and copy them. The great issue, and I don't know how much this has been written about, but to me it was the great issue, particularly when someone like Kennedy made his famous speech about, we'll bear any price, suffer any, whatever it was, to make the world a better place. I thought, so is this a liberal? I mean, what is this guy doing? Well, he's simply repeating what every president almost says in an oath when taking office. In other words, we are the city on the hill, was the phrase. We're the chosen people. And this concept of chosen people, it's very much alive today. And America thinks it can do what it likes anywhere because they're the chosen people. And if you compare them with other people doing the same thing, they get very angry because we're the chosen people. Well, that strand of arrogance, I think, is very deep in Americanism. I mean, it's not lovable. The only thing to be said for it is if it's designed to present America as a successful country, which is open, liberal, kind-hearted, and decent to its people and other people, and thereby setting an example to the world, fine. It's when they go and start messing around with other people's affairs that it falls apart, as it is now falling apart.
And there's another strange strain in American history of this extreme violence, you know, of gun violence today, but it is extraordinary. American presidents being assassinated, from Lincoln to JFK to very closely to Trump. Do you trace that back to the right to bear arms in the Constitution, do you?
Well, it's rooted in it.
Yeah.
That's why the right to bear arms is in the Constitution. And if you read the history of that clause in the Constitution, it's strictly related to the Minutemen. It's to the need to bear arms to resist the British when they come. It is not related to your relationship to other people, your neighbours and so on. But it then relates in turn, which I try and analyse, why is it they haven't withdrawn it? Everything says revise it. They could revise the drinking laws. Why can't they revise the gun laws? Well, one reason is that the nature of American politics makes Washington a den of lobbying. I mean, a lobbyist in Washington is more powerful than a congressman. And the gun lobby and all the other lobbies, the Israel lobby now, they're extremely powerful. And more or less say to a congressman, you either vote for us or we will make sure you don't get elected again. And that's because Washington is a town of politicians. There's no sense, there's nothing to dilute it. If it was New York, I mean, New York's legalized cannabis, you know, I mean, New York's revised the landlord, but it's a civilized city. Washington is not. And the consequence of that is that there's a deep conservatism, which I think in some sense is good. I mean, the aspects of the Constitution, like term limits and so on, which are very important to make very difficult to change. And it's very difficult to change the Constitution. But one price you pay for that is the gun laws.
And we've talked about how revered the Constitution is and how extraordinary it is, but another kind of loophole in it is the Electoral College, which means that you get presidents losing the popular vote, but winning the presidency. That seems something that won't be reformed, but should be, do you think?
Should be, I don't know. No. I mean, the two areas of central constitutional reform that are badly in need of attention. One is the Supreme Court, which is now geriatric. And it was okay when people died when they were 50 or 60. When they don't die till they're 80 or 90, this is a serious mistake. And they've got to reform that, I think. The other thing is, as you say, the Electoral College. Now, the Electoral College was designed to ensure that big states couldn't outvote small states by their sheer size. It was also designed, curiously, as a bulwark against populism. The members of the Electoral College are not bound to vote for the person that their state voted for. They're actually going to the Electoral College to decide, as mature, one assumes, politically sophisticated members of that state, who should be the next president. And if they vote for Andrew Jackson or someone like that, the Electoral College should be able to vote, no, sorry, terribly sorry, you're not a suitable person to be president, we're not going to vote for you, although the nation wants you. And that's deeply undemocratic. That decayed, and the almost universally, members of the Electoral College have to vote 100% for the candidate for president voted by their state. So even if their state's only half voted for Trump, they all have to vote for Trump if only half do. I think Maine doesn't, and I think it's North Dakota or somewhere in the West. For some reason, don't. They vote proportionally. They all ought to be voting proportionally. But there is something to be said for protecting small states. I mean, a state like Rhode Island, which is the smallest state, was endlessly voting against the Constitution because they feared it would be used to crush them. And in that moment in 76, when they'd all got to vote for it, Rhode Island had a lot of power. And it succeeded in having its small statehood defended by the Senate, structure of the Senate of two votes per state.
However big the state is, yeah. You touched on Andrew Jackson, the early 19th century president, and you see echoes of Trump in him. Trump isn't entirely original in his extraordinary approach to the presidency, is that right?
Yes, I mean, there have been so many presidents. Johnson was almost like Jackson, who followed Lincoln. There have been plenty of presidents who really were third rate, second rate. On the whole, and it applied to Jackson and to Johnson, the Senate can outvote them. I mean, the Senate or Congress or between them can veto presidential orders. And the biggest controversy really to arise constitutionally in the 20th century was the status of the emergency order. Because two Roosevelts, Teddy Roosevelt, both of them liberal, and Franklin D. Roosevelt, issued orders that were called emergency orders because they could only be passed in an emergency without congressional approval. And even then, they had to be approved subsequently by Congress. They were the only way in which presidents could exercise autocratic power. But Trump's completely blown the whole thing. But entirely because he's got a majority in Congress. Now, that may not outlast this year. So the Congress is there as a check and balance, and it hasn't yet sort of finished with Trump.
And there was this attempt to buttress isolationism in the form of the Monroe Doctrine, which Trump has now again ridden roughshod over in going into Venezuela. But for a long time, did the Monroe Doctrine sort of hold in an informal way?
Well, the Monroe Doctrine sort of applied to Venezuela. I mean, it applied to Central America. It was seen as applying to Central America. It was expanded by Teddy Roosevelt. Trump's expanded it a bit further, in fact, extremely so. There's nothing sort of conceptually new about that. Many American presidents have sort of dallied with expanding the American sort of sphere of influence. Puerto Rico, all these places, Hawaii. They've all been added to the either as a state or as a dependency. I don't regard it as being completely exceptional. The manner in which he does it, the way in which he describes it, is, I think, unacceptable. But it's not in itself unprecedented.
And we'll finish with that state visit. If it goes ahead, you'll see the sight we've seen already of Trump with Charles III bringing back memories of George III. Is it right to say that Trump has much more power, certainly than Charles III, but much more power than Keir Starmer? And in a way, what has happened is what the Founding Fathers didn't want to happen, is that they have produced a sort of ultimate monarch.
Well, it's very difficult. We've only had this for a year, if that. And he's behaved... I personally believe he's not well. I mean, I believe he's clearly... It's called narcissism personality disorder, and it's a perfectly clinical thing.
And some have suggested he's got early dementia as well.
Well, if you look up narcissism personality disorder in the dictionary, you get an almost precise description of Donald Trump. It's quite eerie. But the defense against it is the Constitution. And the Supreme Court have already stopped him doing one thing. Congress has allowed him to go ahead with one war. They haven't come to terms with Iran yet, but they do have the right to veto his orders. I think he knows that when a Democratic House of Representatives comes in, as is likely to be the case at the end of the year, he won't be able to get away with it. So I don't think this is a disaster yet.
And in fact, you finish your book by saying you're ultimately optimistic about a country which is innately extremely optimistic itself, isn't it?
Yes, America is the home of optimism, and I joined it.
Well, that's a very good place to end. Thanks so much to Simon Jenkins, author of the brilliant book, A Short History of America, From Tea Party to Trump. You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.